One of life's most important lessons is learning how to lose all that we love. And when I say learning how to lose, I don't mean stoic acceptance. I mean growing in depth, in spirit, in wisdom, because of our losses. Loss is with us from the very beginning of our lives. The first cry of life when we are born is a cry of grief at losing the comfort of the womb and being thrust out into a cold, bright world. And so is that heartbreaking wail of a baby who might have a favorite object taken away. In Francis Weller's reading, we hear that these first cries of grief are not just about what has been lost, but they are in fact an affirmation of life and of our intimacy with the world. Because without that cry at birth, there is no life. Being alive and being human is living with loss and learning from loss. So we cry because we live, and we grieve because we love. In that sense, grieving is a grace. It is a gift of life. And this is not just some poetic, intellectual minister trick that's supposed to help somebody who's grieving feel better. In fact, there isn't much about what I have to say that is intended to make grieving go away. Grief doesn't go away because we live with it throughout our entire life. We lose possessions, we lose places, we lose animal companions, we lose stages of our lives, we lose games, we lose friends, we lose jobs, and we lose those whom we love most in the world. So we live with grief in different ways all the time. And I was looking for an image of what it means to think about grief as in this way, as a lifelong companion, and I came across a poem by a favorite poet of mine, Denise Levertov, which is called Talking to Grief. Ah, grief. I shouldn't treat you like a homeless dog who comes to the back door for a crust, for a meatless bone. I should trust you. I should coax you into the house and give you your own corner, a worn mat to lie on, your own water dish. You think I don't know you've been living under my porch? You long for your real place to be ready before winter comes. You need your name, your collar, your tag. You need the right to warn off intruders, to consider my house your own, and me your person, and yourself my own dog. I was having a hard time imagining grief as sort of a lifelong roommate, and something about this poem, the image of a dog living under the porch being ignored until compassion for yourself demands that the animal be invited in, to be recognized, to be nourished, to be the companion. That it makes more sense to me somehow. You know, interim ministers are supposed to preach sermons about grief, at least one, or teach a class or do something, because you are told that any ministry, the successful ones and the ones that didn't end so well, are always going to leave a legacy of grief in a congregation. And I have no doubt that many of you in your own ways are grieving the loss of Reverend Anya. And it's not going to be the first thing you're going to want to talk to me about, because you're too polite and generous and have been too welcoming. But I'm not seeing it as a big problem for us together, but, you know, we should name it. She is missed in many ways that I am never going to know, that only you will. And for some of you, who I am and what I bring as a minister is not going to measure up to what Reverend Anya offered to you, and I'm okay with that. Beyond these circumstances of this ministerial transition time that we're sharing, I was glad for the chance to bring you these reflections about grief today because, oh my God, there has just been so much loss in the world with the hurricanes and now Las Vegas, and there has been loss among the members of this congregation, that taking this time to reflect on our grieving seemed right for this season right now. So I came across an insight from a psychotherapist, a guy named David Rico, that helps me understand how grief remains present in different ways, even when partings and losses have been undertaken well, as I think you did with Reverend Anya. He wrote a book called When Past is Present, and he said that grief is actually not just one thing. It's composed of three emotions, three feelings, all present and intermingling at the same time. Grief is sadness that something was lost. It is anger that something was taken away. And it is fear that it will never be replaced. If we consider what it meant to have Reverend Anya leave after 10 years here without really a lot of time to get used to the idea, it's easy to see that sadness and anger and fear about how the place that she filled in your lives is inevitably going to be a part of our congregational life for this year. And these may not be intense feelings. And over time, actually, they may help us recognize that it is the vessel of the church community that we hold dear more than any particular minister who represents and interprets and that vessel. But recognizing these three sort of primary colors that together create the white light of our grief can help us accept the changing ways that grief will manifest and come up after a loss. Sadness or sorrow is what most people associate with grieving. It's the unhappiness, the gloom around missing someone or something that has been an important part of our lives. My colleague, the UU minister, Mark Bellatini, says that that sorrow is really the feeling that comes with unacceptable loss. And it's a sorrow that can worry our families and our friends if it seems to continue for longer than they may be comfortable with. I think the emotional color that composes in grief that is most difficult to talk about is the anger. You know, anger, we can interpret that as self-centered, sort of a why did it have to happen to me kind of anger. But I think I understand the anger when we grieve better as anger at life, at God, or at the world that we are still living in, which now contains this unacceptable loss that just keeps happening. Love and beauty are still there. How dare it? Then there is the fear, the anxiety that what is lost is never going to be repaired or replaced, that there will never be a new normal, that the world is hostile to our happiness. And that can be a persistent part of this blend of feelings. And together they add up to a pain that is ironically difficult to talk about, but completely familiar to almost everybody. Grieving will isolate us, but it need not, because the church of the bereaved is the largest church on earth. We need to be alone with our grief at times so that we don't hide from it in activity. And as a sign that we are still alive, that we are still here, the suffering that we experience in our grieving should not be buried or ignored. I saw just 10 days ago or so a wonderful film that's out now in the theaters. It may still be there, called Wind River. I don't know if any of you have gone to it. It's a film about the disappearance and murder of several young women on a Native American reservation in Wyoming. And at one point in the film, two men who have both lost their teenage children are sitting quietly together overlooking a valley. And one of them has been contemplating ending his life. The pain is so bad. And the other, his friend, knows that. And he says to him, "You know, Martin, I have got good news and bad news. The bad news is that it will never be the same. You'll never be whole, ever. What was taken from you cannot be replaced. Your daughter is gone." And now, the good news, that as soon as you let yourself suffer, allow yourself to grieve, you will be able to visit her in your mind and remember all the joy that she gave you and all the love that she knew. And right now, you don't even have that, do you? If you shy from the pain of it, then you rob yourself of every memory of her, my friend. Everyone, from her first step to her last smile, you will kill them all. So take the pain. Take the pain. It's the only way to keep her with you. It's hard to hear. Taking the pain is the price of holding the memories. And not being afraid to hold the memories is another part of this grieving process. And I want to say those two words again, grieving process. You know, grief is not linear. It doesn't start with intensity at the time of the loss and then somehow decline at a steady pace and then goes away. Grief is actually cyclical. And it starts in a whirlwind at the beginning, and it spires us around, and we get calm, and we find a place to stand, and then it comes back, and we spiral through it again, and we think maybe the pain is over, but no, there we go. Out of the blue, there will be a place, there will be an object, an article of clothing, a memory, and it catches you up again in the same cycle of feelings. And it seems to cover the same ground, but it doesn't really. It's coming from a different place in your life, a different starting point. And you will find that solid ground again. The cycle of grieving slows down, and it will take longer to come around again. But I don't know that it will ever stop. There are some people who will try to respond to their grief by moving away, making a big change in their lives. But a change of place only changes the ways that the cycle of grief is experienced. I saw another film recently. I'm a big movie buff, and it was called A Ghost Story. Did anybody go to that? You should. Ghosts, you know, are two things at the same time. They haunt places and are associated with places, and they represent people. So this astonishing film is about grief, and it has Casey Affleck playing a ghost, and he's playing the ghost, literally acting for most of the film under a simple sheet with two eye holes. And he stays in place. He stays in the house where his wife lives for a while after his death in an automobile accident. And the film evokes beautifully the cycles of grief associated with staying in a place. We can't really run from our grieving, even as the places and the decades do change around us. And the film evokes some of that too. And I was thinking about my own dad, and my mother's still living, but you know, when you've lost a parent some time ago, it's amazing to me. I find this in my own life. Perhaps you have too. You can wake up from dreaming them so vividly, talking out loud to them, and feeling the loss just as strongly as you felt it when it actually happened. And that happens with all kinds of other loved ones as well. That kind of experience in memory and in dream that Our loved ones are still part of us, still part of the present of us, and not the past, I think is really important to honor in a creative way. The psychotherapist Oliver Sacks has said that we know that our memories are not fixed or frozen like jars of preserves in a larder, but they are alive, they are transformed, they are disassembled, they are reassembled, recategorized, and made into new meanings with every act of recollection. So if we don't treat our memories like frozen articles that we pull off a shelf, and allow them to be alive for us and interacting with us, and allow the relationships to continue to be alive, which they are, not just snapshots, then there's something about the grieving process that is creative in our present and helping us make our future. So I have another story about that that I got from my drives back and forth from Charlottesville. I listened to podcasts a lot. And some of you may listen to This American Life. I don't know if any of you heard a rebroadcast of an updated version of a story that was done last year about a Japanese man who installed a phone booth on his property where he would go to talk to his deceased wife. He called it his wind telephone. And it wasn't hooked up, of course, but rather than seeing him as crazy, some of his neighbors started to come over and ask if they could use it as well. And then the nuclear meltdown and the tsunami in Japan happened, and this was not far from where he lived. And it tore apart the fabric of life in this prefecture for so many people. And the losses were so sudden, just out of the blue. And over time, and this was broadcast, I think, some 5 years after Fukushima, more and more people started to hear about the wind telephone and started to come. And with permission, some of their conversations were recorded and included in the podcast. So you hear the voices of these family members saying what they have needed to say and wanted to say to their departed loved one, even 5 years later, and that they've never had a chance to have a way to do. And of course, no one believes they are really talking to their beloved, but what does really mean? I mean, everybody who comes out of that phone booth feels like they have been in touch with their loved one in a profound and meaningful way. I know that every loss of a loved one is going to have its unfinished business, even if we were able to companion them all the way to the end. And this brings me to one of the disciplines of grieving that I think truly justifies calling grieving a grace. A grace, you remember, is something that we are given that we did not deserve or earn. So in theology, we talk about God's grace as unearned. But you don't have to believe in God to recognize that gifts of life come to us without our bidding. And I believe that finding and offering forgiveness is a grace within grieving. There is much to be forgiven, and we can't just make that happen. This is not an intellectual decision that we make to forgive. It's more like an emotional turning that takes time, like the leaves on the trees in autumn that are turning to make space for new leaves to come in the spring. And that's, I think, what forgiveness and grieving makes possible for us. So what is it that we're supposed to, or have the chance to forgive in grieving those we've lost? Well, it sounds strange, but first we must forgive our beloved for leaving before we were finished, for all that we wanted to do, for not being here, for everything that we are not going to share anymore. And then we have to forgive ourselves for grieving in our own ways and not according to somebody else's idea of what is appropriate or acceptable. Each of our grieving is unique. And as much as there is learning and wisdom that's out there that can be helpful, and I've looked at it and tried to convey it in this sermon, there isn't anybody who can tell you the right way for you to grieve. So you forgive yourself, and especially you forgive all of your dear friends and relatives who worry about you and have their advice and their timetable for how you're supposed to be. They all may have learned some lessons from their own grief, and they are trying to hold you in this community of the bereaved. And you want to let them do that. But know, too, when you need to be alone and what you need to do in your own time. Those who are sharing your grief include family and friends who suffered this same loss, and you may have to forgive them for not grieving the same way you are, even when their style of grieving is creating unnecessary suffering for them. You let them be and forgive them for finding their own way. And finally, and maybe the hardest of all, we have to forgive God for what we lost. And that can be hard if you don't believe in God. You know, so we're talking about forgiving God as a way of talking about what it means to rebuild trust in the goodness of life. We always knew that it was a gift that we had on loan. We always knew that there would be endings. We've lived with that knowledge under our porch all our lives. And maybe you've invited it to come in by the fire and be your dog. That's the best advice I can give to you about grieving. And maybe we shouldn't call that dog grief. Maybe we should call it what it really is. It's love. And we need to invite it in and keep it in close and be glad that it will be safe and welcome in our home, no matter what.